listeners. We said we weren't going to do this. We said for weeks that we weren't going to talk about Bridgerton because we just didn't think we cared enough. And turns out we care a great deal and we had a lot to say.
Right. So it was one of those when the season ended, we were just, I think, calling each other constantly, texting each other throughout. We did joint watches together, you where you were and me where I was, and we were just texting constantly our thoughts and feelings. I thought we were going to come out of this unscathed. We were wrong.
Yes, because I remember watching season one, and I watched it. I'm like, oh, that was enjoyable. And then I never thought about it again, really. So I really was going into season two with, you know, I'm not excited. I'll watch it. I have no skin in this game. And then it made me feel a lot of things, good and bad. So here we are, breaking down Bridgerton.
And I was excited because I did love season one. I did a rewatch of season one. The Viscount Who Loved Me is my favorite book of the series.
Yes, and I did. The only thing I did do, I did read that book right after finishing season one. I did do that. Mm-hmm. But then I forgot about it.
It is my favorite book of the series. So unlike you, where your expectations were low, I was very much excited, very much looking forward to this season. I love Jonathan Bailey. Our friend Leslie, for my birthday last year, gifted me a Jonathan Bailey mug that I take to work. And on one side is Jonathan Bailey, and on the other side is Anthony Bridgerton, or as we call him, Anthony Bridgerton. We're not going to pull the Gwyneth Paltrow thing and refer to him as Anthony. I'm from California. It's Anthony.
Yeah, so, every time they called him Anthony, I'm like, Mark Anthony? No.
So I feel like, you know, I my expectations were high. Were they met? I don't know. We're gonna talk about that. We'll reveal. Do you think being a reader, though, put us at a disadvantage? Having read the book, having enjoyed the book. Did you enjoy the book?
I did enjoy the book. There was a few over-the-top parts where I just wanted to throw my Kindle. A certain incident involving a bee, for sure. But I did enjoy the book. But I also did not remember a great deal of it. Didn't really remember very many specifics. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I tried to go into it not judging it by how faithful it was to the book, but by just how good of a story it was.
Right. And I remember a lot from the book. I'm one of those readers who, if I do a reread, I skip to my favorite parts and do the reread. So I had a lot of, I didn't skip a lot in that book. I know the scene you're talking about, the bee scene, and that's not necessarily my favorite scene either. But there were some parts that as I read through it, I was like, I can't wait for them to do this. I can't wait to see this moment happen. Oh, the office scene, the library scene. So there was some expectations on my part. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I learned a lot about the phrase and the word, or the phrase. I feel like I learned a lot from the phrase based on the books by. And I feel like we learned a great deal about the word adaptation this season.
Yeah, because they played pretty fast and loose with the source material.
And so we have to discuss, you know, the idea is, okay, this is definitely an adaptation. The characters are the characters. They use the names. There are certain moments that stay. There was a lot of moments gone. But I think we have to take into consideration that, or we have to take into consideration now that this is truly an adaptation. It is not the book. It is an adaptation. And I feel like our expectations were, fairly high in regards to how they were going to follow the book because of season one. Season one followed the book more so. And I think that's because I have a theory about that. And I was explaining to some friends about this. It's the first season. You have to put all the cards. Shondaland and Netflix had to put all the cards on the table. Because yes, while Shonda Rhimes does produce television that works, Grey's Anatomy, Scandal. For every Grey's Anatomy, there's a canceled We the People, which is, do you know that show, Jana, We the People?
I sure don't.
Yeah, because it was canceled after like two seasons. Nobody watched it. I think it was canceled mid-second season. And so they have to put their cards on the table. They have to hook that audience in. So I feel like we were given the Duke. We were given a better version of Daphne. I'll say that. I thought, I did not like Daphne from the book. I loved Daphne from the show. So they put all the cards on the table and they gave us great moments. They gave us a lot of sex scenes, maybe too many sex scenes to the point where you were just like, enough already.
We get it. They're horny.
We get it. Shh, this is the Dick of Hastings right now. So I feel like they put, you know, they did this. They hooked the audience and then they were like, we got you now. We know you're going to tune in. So now we're going to play fast and loose with, like you said, the source material.
And I've heard from a lot of different sources that with this second book, the issue was that it puts the couple in pretty much the exact same scenario as in season one, where Daphne and the Duke of Hastings are caught in a compromising position and have to get married to save Daphne's honor. And in the book, The Viscount Who Loved Me, it's very, very similar, where they're in a compromising situation, they get spotted. So like half the book, it's them working through their feelings while married. So I can get where they didn't want to. And that someone was, there was some article, I forget which one it was, sorry, that was saying, you know, in a book, that's fine. And like with historical romance, it's a pretty standard trope. But for a TV show, you can't have back-to-back same scenarios. So they had to change it a little bit. We just have a lot of thoughts on how they chose to change it. And I think we're going to try to keep all the positivity to the first half of this episode, where we'll talk about all the things we liked. And then we'll save all the negative critical analysis.
I don't want to say it's negative. It's more just concerns we had. And we want to say this. Will we watch the third season and still be fans of this? Absolutely. When we started The Nerds Awaken, we started with the idea of finding and celebrating the joy in things things that we consume in pop culture. In our books that we read, the podcasts we listen to, the movies we watch, the shows we watch, finding that element of joy. We never want anyone to be like, well, if you hate it, then why are you talking about it? We didn't hate this season. We loved it. In fact, as we were going through our list, Jana, I noticed we had a lot of things we really enjoyed. There was a lot of elements, changes, things they kept that we absolutely agreed with, that we felt was necessary for the story. Changes we felt that really were necessary for the development and the arc of these characters. There were certain things we didn't agree with. That does not make us less fans, any less fans than we currently are. And we never want to rain on anybody's parade. If you loved this season of Bridgerton, reach out to us. We really want to hear from you, because while we may not have enjoyed all aspects, you may have. And that's the beautiful thing about fandoms. There are certain things you will celebrate and you will love that I may not, but I never want anybody to ever feel on this. So if you loved this whole entire season, that's awesome. reach out. We would love to hear from you because you should, you know, we don't ever want you to feel like you can't celebrate what you, that which you love.
And particularly with this being an adaptation of historical romance, which isn't really done, we want to celebrate this show for the huge achievement that it is. I mean, please, please, networks and streaming services, make more historical romance because there is a glaring lack of it, and it's a huge market, a huge, huge, huge market that is important to so many people. So just, you know, on that level, we are so happy that Bridgerton exists with, you know, with its flaws, even with the things that didn't necessarily work for us, we are still so happy that it's here because, you know, it's what the, you know, romance readers have been wanting for so long.
I 100% agree with you. Completely agree with you. This season, I'm going to be honest, after we were done, I've had more negative thoughts about this season, and I had more critiques about this season and choices and decisions that the showrunners and the writers took.
Well, I think the first viewing is always the most emotional. I think like coming off of episode 8, we were riding an emotional negative high for a lot of reasons.
We both stopped, I think, on a Saturday night. We started on a Friday. We stopped on a Saturday. And we were calling each other. We were texting each other to the point where we kind of said to each other, we're talking about this so much. We have a lot to work through.
Yeah.
So what better way to work through our feelings than through the Nerds Awaken?
Pressing record and working through our many, many feelings is its own form of therapy, really.
And it's completely free. When we decided to record this, we decided, well, in order for us to do this, we should probably do a rewatch. Because by the time we were recording, it would have been a week after we had watched. We would have forgotten certain moments.
Certain beats.
Mm-hmm.
And themes and, you know, watching a storyline for the second time, you just notice more. And it's less of an emotional reaction to what's going on and more of an analysis, a critical analysis.
Right, because you were already expecting these changes that had happened. We kind of let those things go a little bit. We drew these lines in the sand after our first viewing. And then when we watched again, certain lines in the sand that we made, we erased. There are certain ones that stayed.
For sure.
And will stay no matter how many times we rewatch. But there was other things we could appreciate more that we could forgive. And we could understand. Like, okay, I can see where you're going with this. So I feel like this season is one of those seasons that requires a second watch again. For anyone who's, you know, and we have a few friends who have said, I did not like this season. I did not enjoy this season. They took the book that I love and they completely changed it. I would say this, rewatch another time. Now that you know what's going to happen, rewatch, see how you feel after that 8th episode. You may feel differently because I do think that this season deserves that second rewatch.
I definitely appreciated the show the second time through and was able to focus on, you know what? I really, really like this. And, you know, only clarified maybe the things that I really disagreed with. But after the second watch, I was like, okay, I have a little more peace, a little more clarity of thought.
Right.
And I liked it more.
So let's jump right in. Let's talk about what we did enjoy. I don't, like you said, we're going to be going into kind of like, there were some changes that we really didn't sit well with us as viewers, as fans of this series, as fans of the book. There were certain decisions that were made that made us scratch our head a little bit. But there were changes, there were moments that happened that we really enjoyed, and we hope that continues for future seasons. What was the biggest hit for you that the second season of Bridgerton made?
the most obvious and the coolest change I think they made is obviously to make Kate and Edwina and Mary Sheffield Indian, much mm-hmm. like they did with season one, making the Duke of Hastings black, making Lady Danbury black. They went with some Desi cultures, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yeah, so that was a really, really, really cool choice. And it's been so, so fun to hear Indian people's reaction just to seeing themselves, and particularly with Simone Ashley being like a dark-skinned mm-hmm. Indian woman. People have been so thrilled at that mm-hmm. representation. And people have pointed out, like, you know, the leading stars of the biggest show on Netflix are a dark-skinned woman and a gay man. And like, and the odds of that, you know, right. being so low, it's been super, super cool to see. So I love those changes. Loved seeing, you know, the little hints of yeah. the culture. I feel like they could have even leaned into it a lot harder. Just for those of us who aren't well versed in the culture and might yeah. miss like the little Easter eggs. I could have seen it. Yeah. Go well, harder.
I agree. It really was such a positive and necessary change to let other people, especially South Asian cultures, to see themselves represented in a medium that is worldwide, not just specific to certain areas, but to see it internationally represented. The costuming, the jewelry, the clothes they wore, the colors they wore, to the pre-wedding ritual of the turmeric, spreading the turmeric on the bride, which, mm-hmm. by the way, I found out is to make the bride glow the day before her wedding. She puts that on and it makes her glow. To even the way Kate makes tea, because she hates English tea. That's something she and Ted Lasso had in common. They both hate English tea.
And having had, I've at least had like Pakistani chai, and it looked similar to how Kate made it. It is far, far superior. It probably has a little bit to do with the sugar level and the spices, but it is so good. Right. So I don't blame Kate there.
Can I tell you a moment I really appreciated that like touched my heart? Mm-hmm. Anthony calling Kate her full name at the very end. We never yes. heard anybody call Kate her full name. And he calls her full name at the very, very end. I didn't even hear her stepmom, Lady Mary, call her by that, or Edwina.
I know. Well, you texted me because we were watching it together. You texted yes. me and we're like, oh, Anthony's saying her full name. I'm like, have we even heard her full no. name? I didn't know that was her full name.
No, but he did. Maybe he did a little research about her before, you know, in his quest to not fall in love with her. He was sure obsessed with her. And probably he discovered this is her full name. He calls her Kathani Sharma at the very end. And I thought that was just so beautiful and sweet. I really loved the fact that the terms of endearment the sisters called each other were Bon and Didi. You know, they mm-hmm. would call each other that throughout. So all these little, just these little nuances thrown in and letting us understand more about the culture. Now, was everybody in the Indian culture excited about this particular series? No, there were some questions. I know some people were concerned that they didn't really address the idea of colonialism, that they kind of let that slip, because this was about the time of English rule in India and colonialism. So they didn't really explore that, but neither did, well, actually, season one of Bridgerton mentioned something briefly. Lady Danbury does tell the Duke of Hastings about, you know, we were property until the king fell in love with a black woman. Mm-hmm. So, but do I think they addressed the whole entire issue? No.
No. Yeah, we you sent me a Vice article by Devani Salani. And as a South Asian woman, the title is, "As an Indian, I'm so confused about how to feel about Bridgerton 2, I'm not alone." And the article just kind of goes over, like, yes, it's great to see this representation, but it doesn't seem like they put a whole lot of depth into it. Like, just kind of cherry-picking things that maybe don't make sense geographically or culturally. So some people, you know, are like, yeah, you did the representation, but you didn't really do enough of your homework. And then other, you know, other opinions are, they love it. They love to see it. So, I mean, as a white person, I thought it was super cool.
Right.
To see. It added a really, really great depth to the show.
It made me look up certain things. Like, I didn't understand the pre-wedding ritual of the turmeric being spread on the wife, on the bride. I didn't know that. I actually had to look that up and see what are they doing? What's going on here? So it allowed me to explore a culture I had very little knowledge about. So it inspired that from this white person. Now, I'm not an expert by no means.
Just taking our opinion as two white girls, which, you know, doesn't count for a whole lot. We loved that element.
Right. And exposed a culture we kind of knew very little about. So it inspired us to learn more, which, well done, Bridgerton season 2. Well done. And those two women are absolutely beautiful. Like,
unfairly stunning. Beautiful. Simone, stupidly beautiful.
Oh my gosh. Simone Ashley. Oh. When she first appeared on screen and she turns and she takes her hood off when she's writing and she gives that little smirk, for one moment I was like, I know I'm straight. I know I'm a heterosexual woman, a cis heterosexual woman, but I'm feeling stirrings towards this woman. Is that normal?
She's too pretty.
She's too gorgeous. Somebody help me. She was gorgeous. And throughout everything, she was just, her presence was astounding.
Her posture. She just cared. She Girl owned has every scene. Great posture. Oh,
she owned every scene she was in, every single scene, and just took such command of the room, even just with no words, being right there in the moment. Saying nothing, she still, I felt like, took command of the scene. She owned it. And then the woman who played Edwina, Charitha Chandra, I felt she did an amazing job conveying Edwina's naivety, her innocence. And then later on, this kind of strength that came in, and she owned her scenes as well, especially towards the end. I felt like she took command of the show, and I appreciated what she brought to the storyline.
And Edwina certainly had one of the bigger character growth experiences, not always in ways that we liked or agreed with, but Charitha did do an amazing performance taking Edwina from this, you know, bright, innocent, kind of naive girl to a woman, really, who knows her own mind and knows what she wants. So great performances.
And was not afraid to tell people what she wanted at the end.
Yes. Girl learned how to speak her mind, and I loved it.
And I really did like how they included the Sheffields in this, because that is Kate's last name in the book. She is a Sheffield. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated how they incorporated the Sheffields this season. They were nasty. Those two actors.
Well, as soon as they walk in and you realize that the dad is Rupert from Ted Lasso, it's kind of automatically like, oh, he gonna be a douchebag.
And he was. So was his wife. Oh my gosh, Lady Sheffield. Oh my gosh, they were nasty. And you know what? I always think it's easy to play somebody sweet, kind. It's easy to play the hero. It's easy to play the heroine. But there is something about playing the villain, playing the asshole. I think that takes a special talent. And those people did it. They hit it out of the park. Mm-hmm. Because I ended up hating them. I ended up, when we were doing our rewatch, I ended up like applauding Anthony for kicking them out.
Speaking of Anthony, another change we noticed from the book was a little bit of what drives Anthony.
Yeah.
The show did a really good job of doing the flashbacks, I think, showing Anthony's relationship with his father and what his father's death did to him, how he was kind of thrust in this role of responsibility far too early, and how it really shaped the man he became in both negative and positive ways. Right. In the book, Anthony is more driven by the fear that he is convinced that he is also going to die young, like right. his father. And so he doesn't want to love because he doesn't, you know, want to fall in love with a woman, have her love him back. And then, you know, he dies and right. causes so much suffering for her. But in the show, it was more, it kind of kept the last part of that where he's not convinced he's going to die young, but he still doesn't want it to be a source of suffering right. to people like that should he die young.
Well, and that's why he wants to marry, not for love, but more for, it's almost like a business venture. He wants to put that imaginary wall between him and his wife. He doesn't want to feel, because he watched his own mother, he does not want to feel the pain, because he even, one, he experienced it himself. Mm-hmm. Of losing his father young, watching that with his own eyes, and two, watching his mother suffer to the point where she herself wanted to die,
yeah,
losing the love of her life. And I thought
that can be very, very traumatic,
right,
for a young person,
right. And I thought this season explored trauma in a very honest and raw way. Trauma is not pretty. So, for example, when Lady Bridgerton says, I wanted, you know, when she talks about giving birth to Hyacinth and she's talking to Anthony, and she said, she was honest and said, I wanted that baby to kill me so I can be with Edmund. You may not agree with that because you're like, wait, hold up. You got like six other kids to worry about.
Like, and please don't be, this is not something you admit to your 18-year-old son who's right. trying to keep the family together.
Right. But it is an honest look at how she felt and yeah. losing the love of her life. And so he, you know, he takes on this responsibility, but he also has that carried trauma that goes unchecked for the longest time. And his way of dealing with it is he feels like he has to become this stern, almost cold man to keep this family together. But I do love that in the early moments of the season, you know, when they're going, I love the camera work when they're talking. It's episode two. I took note of that at the very beginning when Kate is talking about the love match for Edwina and Anthony is talking to Benedict while he's getting, you know, he's getting groomed. And she's like, he can never love. That's why I don't want you to be with him. He doesn't know love. And then he talks about the love I know is for my family. And that's what drives Anthony. Anthony does love his family, but he was.
Yeah. With all his flaws, and he goes about a lot of things in the wrong way, right. but really getting, because in season one, I did not like Anthony mm-hmm. at all. He was not very redeemable to me. And then in this season, kind of seeing his backstory and seeing why he is the way he is, even if it's still frustrating and annoying, you're just like, okay, I understand. This mm-hmm. trauma, this experience has really shaped him. It makes sense.
Right. And no one gave him time to grieve either. The minute his father died, in his mother's arms, she looks right at him and says, "Go get the children. They cannot see this," not understanding he himself is a child as well, and he shouldn't have seen it. And then it's that flash to all of these servants coming to him and saying, "Sir, what do we do with the body? Sir, what do we do with your mother? Sir, what do we do with this?" And literally he goes, "Why are you asking me this?" And somebody goes, "Sir, you're the Viscount now. You need to make these decisions." So he never even got the ability or the time to process his grief and work through that. Whereas his mother did. She completely got to work through that. And she came out the other side. That's how we get this character today. So I felt that the show, that was 10 times better than the book. In the book, like you said, he's dealing with, "I'm going to die early. I'm going to die early," which when you read that, you're like, really? You think that you're going to die young because your dad did? How would that play out? How would that play out in the series, in the TV series? So that change I felt was necessary and was done brilliantly and explored
very realistic. Felt a lot more organic than the book's explanation.
And then at the very end, when he and his mother have the sit-down talk and he finally cries, that is a testament to Jonathan Bailey's acting too. His quiet, his just tears spoke volumes to the point where I choked up, and I just watched it before we started recording. And I still choked up watching that moment and just seeing the grief, seeing this poor, poor boy being thrust into manhood, doing it by himself. And then to have him finally have the opportunity to express that trauma, express that grief that he has been holding in for so long, and with the woman who was going through it as well.
And to have his mom even admit, like, "I should have been there more for you. I should have helped you with this burden that fell on you far too early." That also must have been very healing, because it didn't seem like he, you know, ever held it against his mother. But
no.
As a mother myself, be like, the mom guilt that would be on me,
well,
you know, to let all this responsibility fall on a child when I'm an adult.
Right. And she sees the impact it made on his life and how he is so hesitant and reluctant to love Kate.
And so afraid. So afraid to love. I mean, even afraid to show love to his own mother and siblings, you know, to the point where, you know, they all almost resent him.
Yeah. Daphne says, "We pity you. You think we resent you, we pity you."
Yeah.
And that's what
Great performance by Jonathan Bailey. Great story arc for
that was great.
Anthony. That was, yeah, such
it was
a big hit.
One of the best changes. That was a hit for me. I was like, God, they got away from that kind of the idea of he's going to die young.
Because that's more like, okay, he seems paranoid.
Right.
Where with this change, it's like, no, like, he is shut down because he has been scarred emotionally. So he's trying to protect himself and protect those he loves.
So while the show made the change with Anthony, I feel like the scene that I loved and adored that they kept and they did well, I thought they was the Pall Mall scene, was the croquet scene where we finally got to see the black mallet of death.
Yes. And I remember that scene. I knew the scene was in the book, but I don't remember very many details, so I can't speak to whether I felt they adapted it proficiently. But I loved that scene because I really love the first couple episodes of Kate and Anthony's relationship. The competitiveness, the wit, before it kind of falls into like the angst and
almost hatred.
Because in this Pall Mall scene, you know, it's their competitive spirits coming out and just playing off of each other. And then when they get stuck in the mud and they're just laughing. And at it feels like, okay, they're finally at ease with each other. Mm-hmm. They're not competing. She's not trying to put him down. He's not trying to win her sister. Like, they're just together enjoying their circumstances. And it felt so real and honest, and they're laughing. And that's like, I feel like I swooned more during that moment than some of the more intense, sexually charged moments later on. Like, them falling in the mud might be my favorite moment from the season.
Well, because we heard that, you know, we heard them laugh. We actually heard them laugh.
Anthony laughed.
He laughed. He laughed with her. And that's, you know, Daphne says, you don't laugh anymore, but he laughed with Kate.
Mm-hmm. And he smiles so much in response to Kate in the first four episodes, like in all of their earlier interactions. That is what felt a little more true to their relationship in the book. It was more sparring and matching wits and a little bit of snark more than it was bickering and fighting. So that all felt very, very true to the book, and was so enjoyable.
Something the show completely gets right is the relationship between the siblings, all of them.
Yes.
These actors have such chemistry together. So we always get them, you know, when they're in the drawing room and they're having their conversations, or, you know, at balls, or but the Paul Mall thing, I feel like, just shows the playfulness of these siblings, their competitive nature. They truly are siblings. The smack talking that happens, that's, you and I both have siblings. Smack talking happens, even in the healthiest sibling relationships. There's that competitive drive. I am not a competitive person, but match me up against my brother in anything. Oh my gosh. There are times we have to walk away from each other.
You should see me and my mom over a game of Scrabble. It gets ugly.
The Paul Mall scene didn't just give us playful Kate and Anthony. It also gave us the siblings and their just their close nature together, their relationships, you know, how they understand each other. I loved that Daphne gave us the rundown of how well she knows each sibling's, you know, strategy. That shows us how close these siblings are, how competitive they are, how observant they are of each other. The season ends with the Paul Mall scene. And then Kate's now fully a part of it. She is now, she's a Bridgerton. And being a Bridgerton is this competitive nature. That's why Edwina could not fit into that scene. Mm-hmm. She couldn't handle the Paul Mall game. But Kate did. Kate held her own. And she was a formidable opponent.
And an excellent fit for the Bridgerton family.
Right. The Paul Mall scene was a complete hit for so many reasons. It was just a fun scene to watch. And I felt like playing croquet afterwards. And I don't play croquet.
For sure.
I kept on calling it cricket, and you had to tell me it's not cricket, idiot, it's croquet.
They're two very different games.
Shut up. They both start with a cr. Another major hit for us. They did include, this was both an adaptation of a scene that was famous, but a well-needed change, was the bee sting scene.
Yeah, so this was a scene in the book where I'm reading it and I want to chuck my Kindle out the window because it just seems so preposterous and awkward. So in the book, Kate gets stung.
Right, and he still has the fear of bees because of his father.
He still flips out. He decides that sucking the venom out of the sting on her bosom is the best course of action. Sucking out bee venom, which I didn't know was a thing. Like, I thought they just did that with snake bites. But okay, Anthony.
Right. Sure. Sure. And then what happens? They get caught by Lady Featherington, Lady Bridgerton.
Is Lady Mary there too?
Maybe. I don't know. But I do know those two, especially Lady Featherington, is like, oh, look at this. And so just like in the Duke and I, they get caught. They must now get married. Even though he was gunning for Edwina, the safe choice. They must now, Kate and Anthony must now get married, and they get married. We did have the bee sting scene, but the show took, once again, the absurdity of maybe the original storyline. And don't get me wrong, I love Julia Quinn's writing. I loved The Viscount Who Loved Me. Not every book can be perfect. Even the most perfect book, my favorite book of all time, is To Kill a Mockingbird. I can tell you right now where Harper Lee loses me sometimes. So I'm not trying to say that the book is not amazing. It is. But that was, I'm with you. That was one scene I was like, mm-mm. And then to have them be caught following the same, almost the same storyline as the Duke and I was not for that. I did not enjoy that. I enjoyed this one more. I enjoyed the show's interpretation of the bee sting scene.
Yes. They definitely adapted it for the good. My only issue, and mm-hmm. this issue is going to come up later, it was more of how they filmed it, mm-hmm. I guess. To me, it kind of bordered on cheesy, okay. a little what? Bit. When they put in the music and the heartbeat and all the whispering, mm-hmm. it's just a bee. Like, I started cracking.
Well, the way you just said it made me laugh.
I said it exactly how she said it. So that was, and I guess, like, I've realized I'm more of a fan of a subtle tension mm-hmm. as opposed to a incredibly, like, overwrought tension. And this, like, that's where the show loses me a lot later on, when it's all this kind of hyped, forced
right.
angst. So, like, I liked Anthony having a panic attack. Yeah. I liked her trying to calm him down. I was even fine with her, like, putting his hand on her boob to match their heartbeats. But right. it was just with the music and the sound effects and the camera angles. It was just, I don't know, it bordered on, yeah, cheesy for
so,
me.
And that's where we kind of a little bit disagree right there, because I was okay with all of those things. I felt that as somebody who has to deal with people who have panic attacks, I tend to find myself lowering my voice, like focusing on breathing. You know, I don't play dramatic music in the back. Maybe I should.
Try it. See what happens.
See how they respond. But I, you know, I felt that I can understand where you're coming from, because it was a little bit, you know, where she had to repeat herself a couple of times, but that's, you know, she had to repeat herself because he wasn't calming down. And the minute they break apart from each other and they stare at each other, I loved that moment, because then they literally ran away from each other.
You know, like scared little baby deer.
They were scared little babies about their feelings and their emotions. And how are they never caught? Do you notice that? They're never caught.
Except the one time by Daphne. But, you know, 10 other situations mm-hmm. that would have easily forced them into a marriage. But conveniently,
they're never caught.
No one ever shows up.
Never.
And they're always, like, outside, too.
I'm like, do they have the Harry Potter cloak of invisibility? What is happening here?
I guess.
But I get it. The second time she whispered again, it was a little dramatic. It was a little over the top. I think, okay,
yes,
this is a TV show. It's not reality. But
and I notice, like, I'm really interested in filmmaking, so I feel like I'm more prone to notice, mm-hmm. you know, how camera angles are incorporated and sound effects, and so it might just be me not able to not be distracted mm-hmm. by those things. Mm-hmm. But those little moments, I'm like, you took it a couple beats too far, a couple angsty beats too far.
If you were to film it, what would you have done differently?
I would have not had her whisper so slowly. And I wouldn't have had necessarily all the sound in there. I mean, maybe like I kind of liked the subtle mm-hmm. heartbeat sound, mm-hmm. but like the extreme close-ups, I don't know. It didn't work for me.
Well, you talked about the music, and somebody posted on Twitter, and I sent it to you. It was the office scene where Anthony says, why do you hate me so? Why do you despise me so? And she says to him, because you vex me. And somebody removed the music from that clip. And I sent that to you. What was your response? Do you remember what you said?
OMG, this is so much better. Because then you're left with just the performances and not all these extras and toppings to try and force this sense of tension and angst. Like, just the performances are fine.
Right. Trusting that. Trust the performances.
Yes. It's the addition of all the extra effects that just pushes it over the top for me.
Right. And that's where I think sometimes productions, you know, it's that sense of you need to trust the process of your actors and what they can bring. And I get what you're saying about like the music and sometimes the camera angles. It's just allow the moment to happen between the two people. We don't need the extra, the added drama to these moments, to these scenes. Because I'll agree with you at the office scene when they were having their fight and the whispering and then, you know, tell me you don't feel anything for me. Without the music, I was holding my breath the whole time. Mm-hmm. And it was still a power, you know, for me, it was a very sensual scene, the office scene. And then without the music, I just felt every whisper, every inch of them moving closer together. I was able to focus on their breathing. You know, there was a lot of breathing.
There is a lot of breathing.
A lot of heavy breathing. A lot of whispering and a lot of breathing.
Someone made a meme just of the subtitles at the bottom. Like, they just stacked all the subtitles. Like, Anthony breathes heavily. Kate panting. Like, over and over and over. It was all just about heavy breathing and panting.
There was a lot. They had a lot of clear sinuses during this season. In a time of COVID, no wonder this show shut down for a little bit, because it did shut down due to COVID. The production had to halt. And I'm like, yeah, look how close they were to each other.
Right.
How sad is that? Thanks, COVID. Now I question actors kissing and breathing on each other. Another big hit for me and another, I think, standout star this season. And she was a standout star last season, too. But it is Penelope Featherington. The only Featherington I really, truly care about is Penelope Featherington. The show last season ended on a controversial note for some people. They revealed Lady Whistledown is, in fact, Penelope Featherington. Now, in the books, and if we say in the books, we're sorry. It's just natural and normal for us to say that. Don't hate on us. But in the books, we don't find out about Penelope being Lady Whistledown until book 4. And it's actually Colin who discovers or reveals to the reader who Lady Whistledown is. We have this added tension of Penelope maintaining her anonymity and still creating these papers that are entertaining and controversial and are pissing the queen off. She pisses the queen off. When I did my second watch, I was like, oh my gosh, she really like challenges the queen. Nobody else does. She does, though, through Lady Whistledown, this meager, mild manner wallflower, her true identity. Because I think Lady Whistledown is really who she is. I don't think Penelope is Penelope, the wallflower. I think she's Lady Whistledown. Penelope is the mask she wears. She's feisty. I love it. I love that she pisses people off. But so this whole season is her not just pining over Colin, which she does from afar. Their moments were sweet together, by the way. I love their moments together. But she's also, you know, maintaining this farce, this ruse, you know, in effort to become, you know, to maintain Lady Whistledown. I loved her including Madame Delacroix in her plan. I thought that was really interesting. That was an interesting mm-hmm. little twist.
Yeah, that was smart. Although at some point I realized late Madame Delacroix had dropped her fake French accent. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm like, at what point did you admit to Penelope that you were not actually French? Because we see it in season one. Mm-hmm. Like, we see her drop her accent.
With Sienna. With,
I think, Sienna. Mm-hmm. At this, yeah. And then in season two, I'm like, whoa, there's been clearly a big conversation that we missed where she's like, no, I'm actually not French. And I liked how Lady Whistledown uses her writing to help Madame Delacroix.
Oh, that was
by like, yeah. You know, turning everyone off of the new modis from Venice. Oh, yeah.
And at the same time, totally like bashing Cressida. I love it.
Which is funny because I'm like, oh, I kind of like Cressida's dress.
I know. There was nothing wrong with Cressida's outfit.
I didn't think it was tacky.
No, not at all. Cressida's outfit was, I know, me too. I was like, oh, that's a pretty color. Oh, I'm not supposed to like it. Looks like trash, bitch.
No, no, apparently it's trashy.
I love that too. I love how they help each other. They scratch each other's back, you know, and eventually gets Madame Delacroix to design the infamous wedding gown that we'll be talking about soon. But I loved Penelope this season. I loved her moments with Colin. I thought their relationship is still sweet and even grew from first season. There's a closeness. So I really am looking forward to, fingers crossed, if the rumors are true, the third season is going to focus a little bit more on them. I'm looking forward to their interactions and seeing their relationship grow and love, hopefully love sprouting soon for them. She deserves it. She deserves it. But the best change when it came to Lady Whistledown was who discovered who Lady Whistledown was at the very end. And it makes sense. It's a change that makes sense. Miss Eloise Bridgerton. I loved it.
Yes, because Eloise has been obsessed with Lady Whistledown's identity since season one. So yes, it made perfect sense for her to be the one to figure it out because it creates excellent drama. And I'm not about drama for drama's sake, no. But it creates such a good drama to take these best friends mm-hmm. and throw this information like a grenade into their friendship right. and see how it plays out and see how they deal with it. And yeah, that fight at the very end was just, it was so good.
Oh my gosh.
That's the kind of drama I live for.
That was so heavy. And you couldn't, it was like a car wreck. You couldn't look away from it. And watching them stand up against each other. And even Penelope holding her own and looking at her and said, at least I did this. You just talk about doing things. You don't do them. And I think that's going to push Eloise next season. And we'll get to Eloise later because her character arc this season was not necessarily my favorite. And I was expecting more for her. But that mm-hmm. fight at the end and the fact that she does find her, she finds out who she is because it's on par with Eloise's character. Eloise is intelligent. She's witty. She's observant. So of course she would find out. In the book, it's actually, spoiler alert, sorry for anyone who has not read the fourth book. I'm about to spoil it in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It's actually Cressida who discovers Lady Whistledown. And it's for the same reason. They're at a ball. Penelope, Cressida says something nasty, something biting. And it's, of all people, the wallflower, Penelope, is the one who addresses her and gives her this talking down and says these remarks that are very much on par with Lady Whistledown. And so it's Cressida who uncovers her and threatens to unmask her if she doesn't pay, ready for this, £10,000 a year.
Come on now. So, only Mr. Darcy gets £10,000 a year.
I really appreciated that change. I felt like that gave a lot of power to Eloise as well. And it allowed Eloise to have some sense of closure when it came to Lady Whistledown. But it's opening a new door for the relationship and how it's going to affect the friendship will clearly, you know, quote unquote, they're no longer friends. Penelope's probably the closest person to her. I would say of all the Bridgerton siblings, Benedict is her closest confidant, but I still think Penelope trumps Benedict. So to have that relationship frayed at the end of this season is going to make for a delicious season next year. Or next season. Sorry. It's going to make for good TV.
Yeah. So that was, excellent change. I mean, because Eloise knows Penelope better than anyone. And she also probably is most familiar with Lady Whistledown than anyone. For her to put two and two together, I thought was a great change.
Hi, everyone. It's Julie. So Gianna and I actually spoke for almost 3 hours about this new season of Bridgerton and decided to split the episode into two parts. The second half of our conversation will be released later this week, where we talk more about what we loved, but also the moments and choices that left us scratching our heads and even asking why. So whether you loved the season, hated it, or were somewhere in between, we hope you join us for part two of our Breaking Down Bridgerton season two.
The Nerds Awaken is hosted and produced by us, Jana and Julie. Theme song by Zayner. Want to connect with us? You can find us on Twitter at Nerds Awaken, all one word. Subscribe to The Nerds Awaken today on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download. And if you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review, and maybe even share with a fellow nerd or two. We would really appreciate it. Until next time.